From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Eugene Hoots, the frontman of the gypsy punk band Gogol Bordello. We can honestly say they're a blast. Hoots and the band were recently introduced by Madonna during the Live Earth concert, and Hoots starred in the film Everything is Illuminated. Also, we meet Michael Harvey, creator and executive producer of A&E's documentary series Cold Case Files. We'll hear about cases they've chronicled, and he'll tell us about his debut novel featuring a private eye who reads the classics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. You may know our guest, Eugene Hoots, from his memorable performance as a Ukrainian translator in the movie Everything is Illuminated. But Hoots was just moonlighting as an actor. Really, he's the frontman for the gypsy punk band Gogol Bordello. Tricia Romano of The Village Voice wrote, "For those who lament that their life is unexciting and worthless, I would prescribe Eugene Hoots for just about any malady you may be experiencing." Gogol Bordello's wildly energized concerts mix gypsy abandon with the driving force of rock. There's a band of musicians on stage with two masked go-go girls who dash around the stage singing and playing washboards and drums. Hoots grew up in Ukraine and came to the U.S. with his family as a teenager. Here's the song Ultimate from the group's new CD, Super Taranta.
If we are here not to do what you and I wanna do and go forever crazy with it, why the hell we are even here? They are today, they are tomorrow. It's a stupid thing we say. Cursing tomorrow is sorrow. Down! Well, we stand here in a row, looking like a bunch of heroes. I know that deep inside, nothing more but a bunch of zeros. Down!
Well, Eugene Hoots, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, your band is described as gypsy punk. If I wanted to convince my friends to come to me with a Gogol Bordello concert, what should I tell them to expect? What are they going to see?
Complete orgasmo hysteria.
Okay. You want to fill that in a little bit? What does the act look and sound like?
Well, I guess, I mean, you can tell them whatever the hell you want to tell them, really, but it's all going to end up in a peak experience of, I guess, emotional kind for them. And show is a show, but this show would never work that well without the music and its foundation, which is gypsy music of my origin. Mm-hmm. And the power of that music is quite known to its fanatics. But for me, it was always obvious that gypsy music can become very much appreciated in subculture, you know, because it was always marginalized and in this world music kind of marketing and all these things that I can't stand, really. You know, it just was basically locked up all these years. When in its spirit, it's basically rock and roll. It's probably the closest thing to rock and roll you can find in the history of music before rock and roll as we know it appears.
Traditional gypsy music, you're saying,
is
rock and roll, yeah.
Absolutely. And it's probably the most passionate, the most flamboyant, the most merry and gay music that there was before rock and roll. It's a scientific fact, basically.
Somebody described a Gogol Bordello concert as something like standing next to a 747. And I can say you sing every syllable of every song with your whole body. I mean, you just don't stop moving. Have you always performed that way?
Basically, that's why I'm not a real singer. Because I never learned how to sing just with that one mechanism. And I never really was schooled in any way, really, either. And it all kind of came from just growing up around music that's basically acoustically made by my own family. Well, my father was quite an entertainer, just to give him a guitar and a party, and there you will have it, a prototype of Gogol Bordello. You know, he is still pretty much an entertainer of refugee community where he resides now with my, you know, with my mom in Vermont.
As a kid, did you perform for your parents?
No, not really. I mean, my dad always stole the show. It was not until in a school, I think it was about sixth or seventh grade, there was some school competition, and where, you know when they have these things where school competes against the school, mm-hmm. in wit and skits and all these kind of things. Anyhow, we had those things back in the Soviet Union. I wasn't even participating, but our team was losing, and they just decided to throw me out on stage, like a last reserve, because I was into punk rock and I had green hair, and they thought it might gonna do some good. And along with that, I did some improv, and that's how we won, basically. So that was my like a first taste of little stage victory, and that's kind of basically. From then on, I decided that that's a pretty powerful place to be, and that's where it all kind of makes sense for me.
And where was that? Did all this happen? Was this in Kiev?
It was in Kiev. It was in my school. Srednya школа номер 170.
And you had green hair back then?
Yeah, actually, we put a medical зеленка, this thing that's supposed to put on your wounds. In Soviet Union, it was green, so I put it in my hair. It burned my skin a lot.
Some kind of medicine to color your hair.
Yeah.
What was it like to wear your hair green then and have all those, have that lifestyle? Did you get in trouble?
Well, it was perestroika time. So Gorbachev just came to power, and it was considered to be okay suddenly. So we get away with, I mean, in school I didn't get much trouble for it, but I would get beat up on a street a couple times, and by other youth organizations that called Lubery and all these pro-Soviet idiotic bodybuilder neo-Nazi kids who would basically pull us in the alley and hit us once in the face and we were done. We didn't take that much effort to put us away back then. We were like 15 years old, just one hit on the head.
So when you formed a band, I know that you immigrated to Burlington, Vermont, which is a college town, and there is a music scene there. And
yeah.
You formed a band, and then you came to New York and started playing this, for lack of a better word, fusion of punk and more traditional gypsy music and all the other influences that you have. Were your audiences just American kids who were turned onto this, or were you finding gypsies everywhere?
No, actually, when I first came to Vermont, to the States, I played in a, you know, basically in hardcore metal bands, and before I formed my own band, and in a band that were much more straightforward punk rock. And the process of getting back into my own, you know, DNA music, it took some years, I tell you. And I also didn't want to do it in a stupid way as some bands do it, you know. I didn't want it to be exploitation of stereotype on any rate. So that had, you know, it was quite a process to find an angle of what it's gonna be like. And actually, the turning point was for me music of Béla Bartók, of Hungarian composer, who worked with a lot of ethnical music, turning it into his own symphonic avant-garde music. So after getting kind of load of how does he process that information, I was able to step up to it without quoting and without just reusing the tunes, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to pick another song from Super Toronto that listen to and tell us about?
I don't know, American Wedding.
I was thinking American Wedding. Tell me a little bit about this song, then we can hear it.
Well, you know, I've been here for a couple years already, to be exact, 12, and I've gone to some of them, American weddings, and it just was a pretty amazing experience. I mean, I just could not believe that people actually would celebrate, or would even call it celebration. And the funny thing is that I wasn't even going to put the song on the album. I just I literally wrote it to entertain somebody in 5 minutes, in 10 minutes on an after party. I just polished up some rhymes later on. But the funny thing about it is that it's the Americans who get the biggest kick out of it, because once it was done, they're like, you have to put it on the album. It's everybody can relate to it. It's just it is what it is. I can't believe nobody wrote it before.
And
it's
the
like, how can we do it like that?
Right.
You know, it just was such a contrast to me, because the wedding in Eastern Europe is 3 days long experience, you know, and just going to conference room rented out till one in the morning, you know, it's like in a hotel is like, ah.
It's lame by contrast. All right, so let's hear the song. This is American Wedding by Gogol Bordello.
American wedding. Where is the vodka? Where is marinated herring? Where is the musicians that got the taste? Where is the supply that's gonna last 3 days? Where is the band that like fanfare? Gonna keep it going 24 hours. Up the chords, everybody's full of cake, staring at the floor. Proper couples start to mumble that it's time to go. People gotta get up early and they gotta go.
And that was the group Gogol Bordello. Singing was my guest Eugene Hutz, and the song was American Wedding.
Yeah, man.
We'll talk some more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Eugene Hutz, leader of the gypsy punk band Gogol Bordello. He grew up in Ukraine, and his family immigrated to Vermont when he was a teenager. Your life was affected by the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, right? I mean, how close were you to the accident? How did it affect your family?
Well, Kiev is 65 kilometers away from Chernobyl, so as thousands and thousands of other people, it's like, of course, we're affected by it, and every way, in mental way, and in geographical dislocation way. And, you know, I feel always hesitant to talk about it, because there are people who suffered from it much, 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 much more. I mean, it was close, but, you know, we still had our things together enough to listen to BBC radio promptly and receive a message that we need to get out. Other people stayed there for weeks and weeks later on. And, you know, that's how Soviet government was working, you know.
You mean it wasn't the government that had informed you? You picked up a BBC broadcast and knew to hightail it out of there, right?
Oh, absolutely. There was no official news for 6 days after the thing. There was nothing. I mean, kids kept going to school. And my dad and I, being rock and rollers that we are, you know, always tuning into BBC, listening to music programs in a Russian language, you know, that was basically a forbidden thing to do. And eventually my dad was busted for that. And it's actually one of the things that helped us to get out. But
your dad was busted for what?
For listening to that. To BBC. He was busted for it several times during his youth. They actually caught him listening to that in the army. And, I mean, there is nothing, it's just the cultural programs, just in Russian language, that were broadcasted from London by this DJ Seva Novgorodtsev. And my dad is either young kids, you know, at that time, was tuning in into that and just listening to, you know, Rolling Stones.
Right.
And eventually somebody ratted on him that he tunes in into this stuff. And,
wow.
And the file started, and the file continued for a couple of decades till there's so much stuff accumulated that, you know, that he was interrogated a couple of times, and we threw a bunch of other stuff together and said, listen, we can't stay here anymore. It's like, what's next? They're going to lock him up, or we got to get out of here.
And that's what led to your family moving to Vermont as political refugees. It wasn't simply fleeing the Chernobyl accident, right?
All of it was like accumulation, because once we were left Kyiv because of Chernobyl, it was already like, even when we came back to Kyiv, it wasn't like we were kind of unsettled there. It was like the move was done. We came back, stayed a couple years, and basically those years were spent on making sure we're getting out for good. And but the thing about, you know, when we were evacuated, as bizarre as it sounds, that actually led me to a major discovery, you know, for my life, because I was a little kid, and as I said before, I didn't think anything about the fact that, you know, my grandmother is gypsy, and, you know, that my uncle is complete fanatic of gypsy music. And when we left and stayed with our relatives, that's where I was actually submerged in a full-on Romani environment for the first time in my life. So after a year of living with them, it had a lot. Maybe it's because I was so young and impressionable, but I think, you know, your DNA is gonna play part in it too. My identification, like, psychologically changed, actually, and it's an important age for anybody, 13, 14, 15 years old, you know. And suddenly I was hanging out with totally different kind of kids who had other things on their mind. And when I lived with them, I experienced different things, that just the feelings that I never had, because the general intelligence and emotional life of gypsies is very different. I mean, everybody talks about, like, gypsy spirit, and it's kind of became this cliche, but more important thing is gypsy psychology, and it's something that nobody can really describe it, because gypsies wouldn't care to describe it to you, and other people just can't understand it.
Well, I guess I have to ask you to describe it. What do you mean by gypsy psychology?
Well, I don't even know if I could fully describe it, but it's something has to do with immediacy of their perception. You know, it's an interesting thing that in gypsy, for example, something I'd found out, they had no, the word for, there is word for today, and akana, and then there is word for the word for tomorrow and for yesterday is the same. It's atasya. You know, and it's like, because that's just not today. In a way, what you see in Gogol Bordello is, it's me recreating what I saw when I lived with them. It's our spirit. It's how we survive. It's our rising above the pressures and contradictions of life.
Well, I wanted to play a song from your new record, Super Taranta.
And sure.
The one I was going to play was the third track, Xena Marina. This song really rocks, and I liked it a lot. But then
thank you.
When I got clued into what it's about, it had a whole different feel to me. Tell us about the lyrics and what the song is about.
You know, I mean, it's about sex trafficking, and Ukraine is the central of that. You can actually, it's as obvious as walking through the streets, because even 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I would still go back, and there would be still tons of hot girls on the streets everywhere you look. That's Ukraine. You know, now you go there, and it's like, where did they all go? Where did they all go is that they're all busy working in Dubai and Istanbul and other places where they're all tricked in. And most of these girls, they're actually from rural areas, and they're not educated about anything. They just answer ad about, do you want to be a model, which is any girl in Ukraine will do in a second.
Let's hear Gogol Bordello's song about sex trafficking. This is Zina Marina. Eugene Hutz will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Zina Marina, Dasha Valentina, Sasha Anastasia, Anna Sofia.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Somerset Maugham's novel, Of Human Bondage, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more music and conversation with Eugene Hutz and Michael Harvey on crime, punishment, forensics, and revenge. Harvey is the creator and executive producer of A&E's Cold Case Files. He has a debut novel featuring a Chicago private eye who reads the classics. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with Eugene Hutz. He starred in the film Everything is Illuminated, but he's mostly a musician. His gypsy punk band Gogol Bordello has built a following for years with their wildly energetic live shows. The group has a new CD called Super Taranta. Well, we should talk a little bit about the film Everything is Illuminated, which is a lot of Americans were introduced to you by that movie. It's the story of, it's based on a novel by Jonathan Safran Foer. It's the story of a young man, American man, going to Ukraine to trace his roots, to track down who saved his grandfather from the Holocaust. And your character, Alex Perchov, is his translator. And I thought we'd listen to a little cut of the film. This is early in the film, and you're sort of introducing yourself to the audience. Let's listen. This is my guest, Eugene Hoots, in the movie Everything is Illuminated.
But now I must tell you more of myself. I am unequivocally tall. I do not know any women who are taller than me. The women who are taller than me are lesbians, for whom 1969 was a very momentous year. For me, America is a first-rate place. Most of all, I am beloved of American movies, muscular cars, and hip-hop music. I also dig Negroes. Most of all, Michael Jackson. He's a first-rate dancer, just like me. Many girls want to be carnal with me because I'm such a premium dancer.
And that is my guest, Eugene Hoots, from the movie Everything is Illuminated. You know, it's a very funny cut, but this is more than just a comical role. I mean, you're kind of the dramatic fulcrum of this movie. You're the translator between the American and the Russian. Uh-huh. There are a lot of quirky characters. How did this role find you?
Liev Schreiber, who directed the movie, has been... I guess they were casting for a long time for that role. And his interest in music and knowledge that band Gogol Bordello exists led him to basically track us down and see if we can do the soundtrack for the movie. And I ventured to the negotiation basically for the music, to the meeting, to meet him. There on a meeting, he actually had this spontaneous idea that, wait a second, maybe we can do more than music. And, you know, I said, sure, you know, I mean, he just basically asked me, am I familiar with the book? And actually it was, somebody just gave me that book. I was reading it like I was on the page 80 or... And he said, do you think you could do that guy, Alex? And I said, yes, of course. And
you had no doubt,
you know,
huh?
If he would ask me to do Grandfather, I'd say yes, too.
Well, the interesting thing about, you know, the character, I mean, the cut we heard is very funny and comical. And there are a lot of funny moments in the film. But there's also some real dramatic, you know, moments where you really have to carry some pretty heavy stuff.
It's a tragic comedy.
Yeah. But you know, what's interesting to me is having seen a performance of Gogol Bordello where there is just so much intense manic energy on stage, and a lot of what you have to do in this is much, you know, much quieter. Did you have to struggle to control your performing impulses here?
Actually, well, it was new territory for me, even though I was encouraged a lot that I'm natural and all that. But actually, Liev helped me, walked me through quite a few things, and that was great. I mean, just I think company of Liev and Elijah both stabilized me in a way, because I'm quite certain that without their company, I would overdo it possibly. You know, I think that from the combination of Liev's and mine kind of rumble tumble is what the role is really is, because I was pushing for much more aggressive delivery. That's just my nature. And I think he led me on to discover other ways of other shades, you know?
Now, I read that you've been acting in a film that Madonna is directing. Is that right?
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's the filming of it is basically done. And that was done in April and May, right before this tour. And this film calls Filth and Wisdom, and I play a lead role. And the band is also in it, the whole Gogol Bordello, as Gogol Bordello. And I basically play a singer of Gogol Bordello.
Well, that should work.
You know,
work,
who
right?
Also likes to dress up as a woman once in a while.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And is that accurate?
Maybe.
Ooh, that sounds interesting.
Let's give people something to talk about.
Do you want to keep acting? Do you want to do more of it?
I think one movie in 2 years is kind of a good speed for me.
About right.
But it's still like, I am just pretty certain that I was put on this earth to do gypsy rock and roll live and recording wise.
And
where I get most of my kicks.
And that led to Madonna bringing you onto the stage at Live Earth and doing a little performing. Has that opened any doors for the band or giving you a wider public audience?
Sure. But everything, I mean, of course, I mean, come on, every third person on the planet saw it. You know, it was televised to 3 billion people. But it was, you know, it's like it's been seen as such a massive publicity stunt and something that was, but it's really, it was just a spontaneous thing because when we were making a movie, you know, as always, I had my guitar and I was playing songs, gypsy songs, other songs, and she really liked some of them. And eventually, you know, we're both singers, we're both entertainers. And eventually we created a little skit on the scene where these two songs, our song and her song, became one song. Mm-hmm. And next thing you know, it was like 10 days before the Wembley. And she just said, how do you feel about performing it? And with me and Wembley, and I was like, you have to like realize what a... doing something like that is a major step for not only for a band and like its you know, exposure and so on and so forth. In terms of perception of Romani culture, that's a pretty massive thing to be part of Live Earth, for example, and for Romani culture to be seen as a positive force along with other forces on that front.
Right.
That's like, I mean, literally after that concert, I had all my gypsy friends calling me from Ukraine, from Russia, from France, just saying like, I can't believe this. This is amazing. I mean, like, I can't believe Madonna was singing with you in Romani, in our language. That's like, that's totally insane. And that's kind of what we do. We entertainers create things that go and bewilder spectators' minds and tell them new things.
Well, Eugene Hoots, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me.
Eugene Hoots of the band Gogol Bordello. Their new CD is called Super Taranta. Here's Gogol Bordello performing with Madonna at the Live Earth concert in London on July 7th. Up, the creator of Cold Case Files has a new detective novel. This is Fresh Air. My guest Michael Harvey is a first-time crime novelist who spent years exploring real crimes as an investigative reporter and as the co-creator and executive producer of Cold Case Files on the A&E channel. It was one of the first TV programs to focus on solving crimes with forensic science. Michael Harvey earned a law degree from Duke and practiced briefly before getting a master's in journalism and becoming an investigative reporter and TV producer. His novel focuses on a former cop in Private Eye named Michael Kelly, who gets pulled into an unsolved rape and battery case that leads to revelations of police corruption. The story involves complex relationships between cops, crime victims, prosecutors, and journalists on the streets of Chicago. It's called The Chicago Way. A warning to listeners, one of the real crimes Harvey describes in our interview includes some disturbing details. Well, Michael Harvey, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, the main character in your book, it's who tells us the narrative, there's a guy named Michael Kelly. He's a private detective and a former cop. He's also a guy who loves the classics. He has Plato and Aeschylus around. And I know that you studied classics as an undergraduate. Yes. Is that a bit of you in this guy?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I think when you go to create a character, you bring kind of a toolbox with you. And in that toolbox are, among other things, your lifetime experiences. And when you start to look at what these guys really talk about, they're some of the great observers of the human condition in Western civilization. I mean, you're talking about Homer and Aeschylus and Sophocles and Plato and Euripides, and they're often writing about greed and murder and lust and revenge and all of these things that are also in, you know, modern crime novels.
So the cop that sort of sees the worst society has to offer draws on the wisdom of the ages in a way.
Exactly. And for example, in the book, there's a lot from Aeschylus and the Agamemnon. And the Agamemnon in that trilogy of plays is really about revenge. It's about taking the law into your own hands and these blood cycles of you killed one of my relatives, I'm going to kill one of yours. And this goes on for generations and generations in the plays that Aeschylus wrote. And he eventually supplanted that with a system of laws and a system of justice where you could go to society and get justice and you didn't have to take the law into your own hands. And when you flip it forward thousands of years to, you know, the Untouchables and to the Chicago Way, you have people that are not happy with that system and are now going back to, let's take justice into our own hands.
Well, you know, it did strike me that, because I also noticed that in the book, vigilante justice is a real theme here, and not just among victims of crime, but among the people who are supposed to enforce and uphold the law. I mean, cops who actually think about administering the ultimate vengeance on someone. Did you know cops who you thought would do that? I mean, would
I didn't
plug
know cops
somebody
that,
rather than take them to court?
Yeah, I didn't know cops that would actually do it. I think I know cops that would like to do it, and would you know, if you're in the system long enough and you see somebody walk, a lot of these guys are, you know, they get upset about that. I don't think they're, I don't know anyone that would actually do it, but it's interesting to think about it and what would push you to take that extra step. And that's what makes for an interesting story.
You know, one of the themes of this book is rape in its many forms and lasting consequences. Was this a particular interest to you, exploring what rape does to its victims?
Yes. Yeah, it was. You know, the crime of sexual assault, you have, honestly, everyone thinks of the crime of sexual assault as the stranger-on-stranger rape where some woman is walking down an alley and is confronted. But you also have a woman who's raped in the context of a 20-year marriage by her husband, a woman who's a sophomore in college who's raped in the context of a date, the uncle who rapes his 10-year-old niece. All of these wide range of crimes are all called sexual assault, and yet they're not at all similar. The motivations aren't similar. The crime patterns aren't similar. They're just not similar. So it's a very complex crime with a lot of different strands to it and a lot of different types of crimes, and yet we call them all sexual assault. And one of the things that I wanted to do was bring out the effects of sexual assault on women and talk about what a complex crime it is. And you do that in the context of the novel. You have to keep the novel moving forward, but every now and then you like to try and bring a couple of these social issues sort of to the surface or let them just bubble underneath the surface. And that was sort of what I was trying to do. The other issue in sexual assault that was very interesting to me is the backlog of rape kits that we have in this country. I've walked into evidence lockers all over this country where there are thousands of rape kits sitting up on a shelf, never been looked at. Massachusetts just last week found 16,000 rape kits, evidence kits, that they didn't even know they had. And these are crimes that...
When we say rape kits, we're talking about the evidence that's gathered, and the physical evidence gathered from a woman immediately after the crime.
Exactly. And a lot of states, they just don't have the money or the manpower to get in to test all of these, and that doesn't help the women who have been sexually assaulted who are waiting for answers, and it doesn't help the fact that these guys might still be out there. In fact, they are. Some of them are, for sure. When you have 10,000 rape kits, you definitely have some hits in there, and you definitely have some offenders who are out there probably still offending. And that is a unique circumstance to me, because there aren't many times in the criminal justice system where you know you have the answers there, and yet we just don't have the money and the manpower to dig them out. And we know we have the answers that are bulletproof answers, because you're talking about DNA.
You ended up co-creating and being an executive producer of Cold Case Files on the A&E channel, which, you know, focused on long unsolved crimes which were eventually solved. And I guess it was the first Cold Case Files, and certainly one of the most dramatic that I saw involved. I think it was called The Boy and the Monster, and it really begins with the discovery of a body of a 15-year-old girl. Right? What condition was her body in when it was found?
Well, her body was found abandoned, I can't remember the town, but it was abandoned in a field, and the fingers had been cut off. And one of the reasons why the fingers were cut off, the police knew immediately, was because whoever killed her didn't want this person identified. And what that tells the police is that if we identify this girl, we're probably going to find the killer, because it's probably somebody she knows. And that's a for sure thing when you see a body like that.
So she's buried without identification, and then there's... Yeah. A break in the case, right?
Yeah, there is. They reconstructed a photo of this girl, and they were able to link her to Milwaukee, and they believed that she had been a prostitute. And the first person that they looked at was a person who they believed to be her pimp. And so they go, and they go to his house, and they find his young son there, and they start talking to him. And they're actually rolling tape while they're talking to him. And he starts telling them a story about daddy keeping a monster in the cellar. And they're like, well, you know, what are you talking about? And he's kind of telling the story as if it's almost a fairy tale. And they're like, well, why don't you take us down the cellar and show us where the monster is? And so this boy walks them down the cellar and says the monster was right there. And he points up to some pipes near the ceiling. And he starts talking about how daddy had the monster hung up in the cellar from these pipes, and that and then the cops are like, well, what happened? What did daddy do to the monster? And the boy says, well, daddy cut off all the fingers of the monster. And he starts, you know, pointing to his fingers, saying he cut off this finger and this finger and this finger and this finger. And he's basically describing a homicide, and he's describing the exact wounds that were suffered by this girl. And the police, obviously, when they hear this, they have the link that they need to this guy, and that's pretty much how they broke the case and put the case together.
Michael Harvey, his new novel is The Chicago Way. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with Michael Harvey. He was co-creator and executive producer of Cold Case Files on A&E. He has a new detective novel called The Chicago Way. One of the things you had to confront as the producer of these documentaries is mm-hmm. how graphic you want the depiction of the crime to be. And there are crime scene photos and other yeah. depictions that are pretty disturbing to look at. Mm-hmm. How did you make those decisions?
Well, that's a hard call. I mean, what we tried to do, one of the first premises of the show was not to do recreations and not to use actors or anything like that, which a lot of other nonfiction series use. And that's okay, but we just wanted to use real cops and real evidence and sort of the real thing. But we always tried to be, what we always thought was, the first few seconds, the opening moments of our show are often the last few seconds of someone's life. And we tried to always... honor that and treat them with the respect that they certainly deserve, and that the family, if we're talking about a homicide, and the respect that the family members of the homicide victims deserve, because we would often talk to them as well. And we would talk to them about how we were going to use certain photos, and there were lots and lots of photos that we wouldn't use. But we would often talk to family members about, well, we might use this photo, we might use that. Have you seen this before, and are you okay with that? And that was often a litmus test for us in terms of what we would actually use.
When we look at most of the cold case files, I mean, these are cases where a crime has been solved, and mm-hmm. the police have done hard work, and prosecutors have been committed to the case, and they get the credit mm-hmm. they deserve for solving a crime and bringing justice to victims. But, mm-hmm. you know, so many people who have contact with the criminal justice system, both, you know, as victims of crime and in other roles, find that it doesn't work well, that cops yeah. don't sometimes get on the case, and things do get lost in the shuffle, and legal technicalities screw things up, and people who ought to be monitored on parole aren't. And, I mean, I know you're a storyteller and not a mm-hmm. policymaker, but as you do these, I wonder, are you ever thinking that there are that this system is in serious need of some reforms? Are there priorities that you think are the things that need to be done to make it better?
One of the things, the name of my novel is The Chicago Way, and what The Chicago Way is about in some form or fashion is taking the law into your own hands and revenge. And that's what people resort to when they feel like the system isn't working. And you kind of hear that a lot, that, well, you know, the police aren't going to do anything, or even if this guy goes to trial, he's not going to get what he deserves. I think that the system, it's not a perfect... I'll give you another good example, a cold case that we did with Jerry Elster. This is a really good example of
the
system not working.
Yeah,
system not working, and someone working within the system to make it better. She was sexually assaulted, and six plus years after she's assaulted, she gets a call saying that we've identified the person who raped you. We have a DNA match to this guy, and he's just about to get out of jail, but he's going back in jail because we're going to charge him with your rape and put him away, you know, forever or for a long time. And she's ecstatic. And then it was like a week or a month later, she gets another call, and they tell her, oh, you know what? We can't prosecute this guy because the statute of limitations has run on the crime. And so it's too late to prosecute him. In fact, we have to let him go. So they've identified the guy. They've told her that they've identified the guy. And now they're telling her, we're going to release him back into society. And she, instead of getting angry, instead of getting bitter, I'm sure she had some initial anger, but instead of hiding in her room, she decided to change the law. And Jerry Elster was instrumental in changing not only California's laws, but laws across the country, so that now in most states they have a DNA exception to the statute of limitations in sexual assault cases, which essentially says that anytime you get a forensic match, a DNA match on a rape, even if it's 20 years after the crime was committed, you have a period of time, usually a year, in which to bring the case. And so now that will never happen again. It doesn't help her. It didn't help her with her case. But, you know, she took matters into her own hands, worked within the system, and helped to change it. And she's a remarkable person. And those are the kinds of stories that, you know, you just love to do.
The stories that you tell are really dramatic ones, and Americans have sort of seen a lot more shows which depict the criminal justice system as it really happens, and then there are the cops shows that actually follows police on what they do. I'm wondering, do you think this whole realism and look at actual law enforcement and courtroom dramas have changed the way Americans view crime and law enforcement?
That's a good question. I do, in the sense that I think they think it's a lot easier than it is in many ways, because of CSI and because of a lot of the fiction that's out there. As I said, you have to telescope events to create a dramatic premise often in CSI and in novels as well. And so they think it's a lot easier than it is. It's very painstaking. It's a lot of legwork. It's a lot of patience. And it's a lot of take one step forward and two steps back before you actually make the case. And people don't want to hear about that because it's kind of boring, but that's really the way it is.
And sometimes you don't find them.
And sometimes you don't find them, right. And sometimes you find them and you can't prosecute them. That happens too. And that's very frustrating for people, but it's like, you know what? I know this happens a lot. A cop will say, I know this guy did it, but I just don't have the case, and I have to wait. Because you only get one bite at the apple when you charge somebody, and you better have the best case you can. So sometimes they'll have enough, they think, to maybe get a conviction, but they're not quite sure, and yet they don't want to charge somebody because if they charge them and they lose, they don't get a second chance if some stronger evidence, for example, some stronger forensic evidence comes along. So often they'll sit on a case, even though they know that they have the guy or they're pretty sure they have the guy. It takes a lot of discipline to not only bring the right case, but to bring it at the right time.
Well, Michael Harvey, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Okay.
Michael Harvey, his debut detective novel is called The Chicago Way. Next week on Fresh Air, we'll feature an interview with saxophonist Harry Allen, whose new CD of music from Guys and Dolls also features singers Rebecca Kilgore and Eddie Erickson. Erickson will also join us for the interview. Let's close with music from that CD. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
I've never been in love before. Now all at once, it's you. It's you forevermore. I've never been in love before. I thought my heart was safe. I thought I knew the score. But this is wine that's all too strange and strong. I'm full of foolish song, and out my song must pour. So please forgive this helpless haze I'm in.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Social Intelligence, The New Science of Human Relationships by Daniel Goleman, author of Emotional Intelligence. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation, featuring Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism by Will Baumol, Bob Lighten, and Carl Schramm at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Peter Fonda. The veteran actor talks about his father, making Easy Rider and starring in Yulee's Gold, and about getting shot, both in real life and in his new Western 310 to Yuma. Join us for the next Fresh Air.